I cheered recently when the richest man on Earth had himself rocketed into space. But then he came back down. There's nothing irredeemably wrong about being rich. Indeed, one good role model for handling wealth rather than letting it handle you is music superstar Dolly Parton. She donated a cool $1 million to the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in 2020 to help finance its development of the Moderna vaccine that's now preventing millions of people from dying with COVID-19. Then there's ugly rich, like Amazon kingpin Jeff Bezos, who keeps spending gobs of his unsurpassed net worth on vainglorious purchases that end up revealing his essential worthlessness. Last month, combining cluelessness with callousness, he actually ran a global media campaign to glorify him for spending untold billions on an 11-minute ego trip to the edge of space. Back on Earth, he publicly blurted out that Amazon's underpaid and abused workforce should be applauded because, quote, "you guys paid for all this." Meanwhile, Wall Street speculators keep bloating his personal fortune. On just one day last year, his wealth was jacked up by $8 billion. One day, for doing nothing, didn't work longer, harder, or smarter. Yet, he's had years in which he paid zero income tax for the support of our nation. But this year, Jeff suddenly became a philanthropist. Increasingly ridiculed as a self-indulgent rich jerk, he loudly announced he was giving $200 million to charitable causes. Wow, how generous! Except, that's no sacrifice for Jeff, it's pocket change. Doling out two big bills means he still has $161.8 billion in his vault. This is Jim Hightower saying, we don't need self-serving charity. We need a wealth tax to restore a bit of fairness and to support America's common good. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, the big news was the NLRB, according to the reports coming out, they're going to set aside, down the road this is going to happen, they're going to set aside the election in Bessemer, Alabama, of the workers who wanted to join and form a union at the Amazon plant there. Going to set that aside because of all the, and I love the word, improprieties. You mean rule breaking. They were breaking the law. All of the law breaking. That's what the headline should have said, not improprieties. And my take on it is they broke the law. There should be a penalty. There should be a penalty. And that penalty is immediate union recognition. None of this stuff. Oh, we're going to set aside the election and we'll run another one. That is not a punishment to Amazon. And here to share some thoughts on the potential NLRB decision, where we are at this moment, maybe where he sees things going, I've asked John Logan to come back and talk with us. John's a professor and the director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. He has written extensively on the Amazon organizing campaign, which is why he's the perfect person to come back and share some thoughts. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be on, Rick, as always.
So at this moment, it's not official. We've got a hearing judge saying, you know, this is what he's recommended. Do you see this going forward? Did you see them setting aside the election?
Yeah. So, didn't mean to interrupt. So as you said, what we have is the hearing officer's report and recommendation, and she's recommending overturning result. It has to go now to the regional director for a decision, in this case, NLRB Region 10 Atlanta. And before that happens, the parties, both Amazon and the RWDSU, can file exceptions to the hearing officer's report. And it can take a number of weeks before the issuance of the hearing officer's decision. But having said that, it would be uncommon for the regional director to overturn a recommendation from the hearing officer. And it would be particularly surprising in this case because, you know, I was saying to you before we came on, I attended every minute of that post-election hearing. I also know, you know, this hearing officer has a good reputation at the board. She's an experienced agent who does a good job, and the report did not omit any important issues. And so I think the regional director is going to issue a decision recommending a rerun election and setting out a timetable for a rerun election. Now, again, as you know, that's not the end of it. So when we get the regional director's decision, you know, likely in a few weeks, either party can file a request for review by the full National Labor Relations Board in DC.
Right.
Now, the board must grant that request. It's not a right of review, it's just a right to request. If the board grants a review, then in this particular case, the board's decision is actually final. There is no, in this particular instance, there's no appeal to a federal court in a representation case such as this. The reason is that the case was limited to objections to the Bessemer election. It wasn't a consolidated unfair labor practice case. You know, there were other unfair labor practices during the campaign, including the alleged termination of two pro-union activists who were engaged in union activity. That was filed as a separate complaint with the NLRB. So as a result, because it was simply objections to the election, it was heard by hearing officer, not by an administrative law judge. And so Amazon does not have the right to appeal it to the federal court, which is a good thing for the union. So again, this is my understanding. I've spoken to board members about this. You know, I've been told that is correct. It doesn't mean that Amazon doesn't have any further recourse. I mean, of course, you know, when you have like an unlimited financial and legal resources to fight these things, there are always things that you can do. And I'm happy, you know, I understand the process that they could object to take this objection further. But that would probably require the certification of the union by the board, which of course, you know, if we're talking about a rerun election, the timetable for a rerun election will be set out by the regional director, but the timing of course would very much depend upon what then happens with the appeals process if it actually goes to the full board in DC. If that happens, typically that process actually takes several months. The Obama NLRB did try to speed up those decisions.
Right.
Of course, you know, everything went backwards with the Trump NLRB. We still have a Republican majority at the moment, but we very soon, you know, two Democrats have been nominated. When William Emanuel, one of the Republicans, steps down at the end of August, he will be replaced by a Democrat. We will very soon have a Democratic majority on the NLRB. So, you know, that process can take several months, but that would be the end of it. If Amazon, you know, and Amazon would be likely to lose before the full board, if the union were eventually certified, and of course that, you know, that's a very big if at the moment, because winning rerun elections is incredibly difficult, as you know. I mean, we can only say that, you know, typically unions tend not to fare well in these rerun elections, you know, when the employer has already committed unfair labor practice, when it's, you know, already created an atmosphere of fear and intimidation and terror, when it's already poisoned the well, you know, whatever way you want to put it, it's very difficult, you know, for the union to come back and win a rerun within a relatively short period of time.
Right.
However, if the union were to win a rerun election, then the employer can refuse to bargain, which triggers a refusal to bargain unfair labor practice. The board's decision in that case, you know, typically those are resolved through what's called summary judgment process, can be appealed to a federal court. And, you know, the employers fare much better when those decisions actually go to federal court.
Right.
So, but, you know, in terms of the rerun election, I think as things stand, things look reasonably good. The problem, as you say, is, you know, even a rerun election, that's not a real penalty,
on
the company. No, no. But, you know, it does, you know, I read the decision today. I got it from the NLRB this morning. It's about 70 pages long, but as I say, a lot of it was very familiar to me already, having attended the hearing. It makes very clear that Amazon's behavior was completely unlawful, that what Amazon did, you know, particularly around this mailbox, it wasn't the only issue, but it was the sort of centerpiece of the unfair labor practice charge. And, you know, some people might sort of say, oh, come on, just a mailbox. Really, you know, if you had sat through this, you would understand how this, you know, mailbox, which Amazon got by pressuring the most senior management, by bullying them, by harassing them, into installing a one-time, one-customer mailbox for an NLRB election, which the senior postal appearing under subpoena at the NLRB hearing, terrified of saying anything that would upset Amazon, said was the only time in his decades at the Postal Service had a mailbox been installed in anything like these circumstances. And not only that, this is like after Amazon had been told by the board on several occasions, no on-site balloting. So then it went ahead, bullied the post office getting this mail, and it asked the Postal Service, can we put election slogans on the actual physical mailbox? And they said, no, under no circumstances can you do that. So what they did is they covered it with a tent, with a marquee, and they plastered the marquee with election slogans. They recreated the atmosphere of a polling booth, albeit a polling booth that was plastered with Amazon's vote no election slogans. In every communication with workers, they said, vote early and vote using our mailbox, the one that we have 30 cameras pointing at from the front of the building. This mailbox really did transform the entire, every worker who testified said they were aware of the mailbox, that they didn't trust Amazon, that they didn't know who had access to the mailbox, that they didn't know why the company had been allowed to install the mailbox. You know, it really changed the, but I mean, that was a minor, it completely changed the election, but you know, it would take us several hours, probably several days, if you wanted to ask me, like, go over all of the anti-union things that Amazon did.
And the thing is, you know, it's not just Amazon who gets away with this. It's most employers who do this.
Absolutely.
And they all get away with it. So I've been saying for years, there's got to be real teeth. There's got to be a real punishment. And that is, they should have imposed union recognition on that facility. They should have been forced into bargaining. And we need laws that make sure that there is a contract at the end of the road. Because here we know, even had they imposed union recognition on Amazon, they can drag the bargaining process out for the entire year and seek a decert vote on the other side.
Yeah.
We know the laws are so badly broken.
Yes.
We know they're intimidated. And the other part, John, that gets me is this is a place that has enormous turnover. I probably bet that there isn't one person left in that Bessemer facility who actually signed a union card wanting the election. So at some point, Amazon, I'm assured, is going to turn around and go, well, there's nobody here who signed a card. There shouldn't be an election. And then, oh, you're right. You win.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And you know, again, we talked about this briefly, but according to, you know, the New York Times had that wonderful, you know, really in-depth journalism, you know, on Amazon a couple of months ago about what it's really like to work there. They have 150% turnover per annum in these fulfillment centers, you know, way above the industry average. I mean, we're not just talking about, oh, that's what warehouse jobs are like. No, that's what warehouse jobs are like if you work for Amazon. You know, exactly. They essentially have a new workforce every 8 months for, you know, two very obvious reasons. One is that there's just absolutely punishing physical and psychological pressure, you know, which was described again at great length. But, you know, we've read about it time after time after time. You know, people just physically and psychologically cannot take these jobs very well. Second, there's no career path. There's no way to move up. You know, they talk about this $15 an hour starting wage. You know, $15 is lower than the median wage in Jefferson County in Alabama, where that warehouse is located. And it's lower than the wage rates for unionized warehouses in Jefferson County. But you can't move much higher than that. You know, the point is, you know, there are very few openings for people to make careers at Amazon, and so they leave. But you're quite right about the board. I mean, I agree 100%, you know, that this is just not a sufficient penalty. And, you know, the Biden NLRB, when we have a Democratic majority on this board, I mean, I know we sort of learn to be cynical about these things, and with good reason, but this board really needs to start, you know, working seriously. You know, I like Biden. I think he's been good for labor, but, you know, the time for nice words is over. Now we really need action. And, you know, they need to take on, and Amazon, as you said, everyone gets away with it, you know, who fights a union, almost everyone gets away with it. But Amazon is more important than almost anyone at this point. Yeah. And so they need to target, you know, the egregious, you know, habitual labor law violator. I mean, Amazon, this is not the first time. It's not the second time. It's not the third time. You know, there was a story in Vice today, a wonderful story by Lauren Gurley, who I spoke to this morning about the story, about the board finding Amazon guilty of anti-union behavior in Staten Island in New York at an organizing campaign going on there. So, you know, the Obama NLRB, and this is very limited, but it's a start. You know, what they did with Walmart is that they started to issue consolidated complaints based on a widespread nationwide pattern of anti-union behavior.
Right.
We need the same at Amazon because, you know, Amazon is the poster child for labor law violations at this point. I mean, it may not have had as many cases because it's not been around for so long and unions haven't been trying to organize there for so long. But every single time you organize now at Amazon, you are going to get a blistering anti-union campaign, which is going to be lots of things that are legal that shouldn't be legal, but unfortunately are. But it's also going to be illegal stuff because for them, that's just the cost of doing business. And the law is no deterrent, as you said. And, you know, when they violate the law, there's no proper punishments because, you know, the penalties are meaningless when it comes to a company like Amazon. So, yeah, you know, from the, you know, the Biden NLRB and the Biden Department of Labor, you know, which can there's things that they can do, and they need to start taking on the Amazons of this world. You know, these superstar companies that have, you know, almost unlimited resources and are using them to crush their workers' attempts to organize time and time and time again.
No, I'm right there with you. And again, you know, the punishment usually is don't do it again. Don't do it again. Post a notice.
Yeah.
Post a notice. Promise you won't do it again. Post that notice for 30 days.
Yeah.
And then after on 31 days, they start doing it all over again because the notice came down. There has to be real teeth. So, you know, in looking at the talk about the PRO Act, and look, I don't think the PRO Act's enough. I want a full repeal of Taft-Hartley. I want to return to the original intent of the NLRA. Doesn't look like we're getting that either, but might get some financial penalties. Do you think in a case like what we're looking at Amazon, that, you know, $50,000-$100,000 fines per violation it would be enough to deter Amazon from continually breaking the law? Or do you just think, you know what, even that's not even close to enough to holding them accountable?
I don't think it's enough in a case like Amazon, but I do think, you know, it would be a step forward. Like you said, the most likely thing, it looks like, you know, at this point is, you know, through this budget, you know, bill, huge, you know, $3 trillion budget bill that's only supported by Democrats, that would have to pass the Senate through this reconciliation process. So the things that are included in it must pass muster with the Senate parliamentarian. God knows who came up with this idiotic system. But, you know, and they have to be clearly budget related. And that's why you get the financial penalties out of the PRO Act and not all of the other things in the PRO Act that we really are, you know, urgently need and would like to see. And so, as you said, you know, they have this system of financial penalties, you know, 5,000, you know, first offenders, 10,000 repeat offenders per violation per worker. And, you know, pretty, you know, it adds up. But, you know, it adds up, but, you know, if it adds up to, you know, hundreds of thousands, even if it were to add up to millions, you know, again, to Amazon, it's the cost of doing business. You know?
Amazon spent $200 million you know, putting this back. You know, what's another couple of thousand? So last question I've got for you, because I keep coming back to this moment that, you know, we're reliving the Gilded Age. We're reliving the era of robber baron class and their monopolies and crushing of labor. At some point, we need a trust buster. At some point, Amazon is getting too big. Walmart's too big. A lot of these things are too big. They've got too much outweighted power. We got to start busting some of this stuff up.
No, 100% agree. And again, you know, as we spoke about before, but I think the really positive thing here, it's not the possibility of a rerun election, which is going to be really difficult for the really positive thing is it keeps this in the news, keeps the spotlight on it.
Right.
People get to see what, you know, egregious bully Amazon is, you know, how it has no respect for its workers, no respect for consumers, no respect for the environment, and on and on and on. You know, and, you know, eventually you can only hope that this sort of helps to create a national dialogue around these issues, like the need to strengthen workers' rights. And, you know, I mean, I know it's in sort of platitude, but, you know, no one likes a bully. No one likes a cheat. You know, Amazon has been found out to be a bully. We've known that for a long time. It's been found out to have cheated in this NLRB election. So, you know, you can only hope that, you know, that this sort of adds to creating an opportunity to tackle these issues. And I do think, you know, I mean, we've spoken about this before, you know, it's very unfortunate that we don't have the situation, you know, in the Senate that we had when Obama first came in, you know, in 2009, 2010, because I do think with this administration, you know, understands the importance of these issues and, you know, campaigns like Bessemer and, you know, the incredible media coverage, including on this program that you've given to it, it actually has gotten people's attention. You know, people are paying notice, you know, to the issue of labor rights and the brutality, and you're understanding the brutality of anti-union campaigns in a way that they haven't before. So, you know, we can only hope that things like that, I think, you know, open up an opportunity and that, you know, we're able to make the most of whatever opportunities arise.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And as it continues, we'd love to have you back to keep us up to date on what you're following and what you're seeing. John, as always, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Okay, thanks very much, Rick. Glad to be on always.
Good stuff. John Logan, professor and director of labor and employment studies there at San Francisco State University. As I said, he's written extensively on this. We'll get some links out on social media. You can check out his writing. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. That was the day 13,000 workers in the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, or PATCO, went out on strike. Highly stressed workers had been driven to nervous exhaustion by long hours, problematic technology, and brutal management. They wanted better pay and working conditions and a 32-hour work week. PATCO workers had proven that militancy bred victories throughout the 1970s. But public sector employers went on the offensive as the decade drew to a close. By the time Ronald Reagan was elected to office, automation, deregulation, and inflation had taken its toll. As Joseph McCartan details in his book Collision Course, controllers found new technology unreliable. They experienced, on average, a computer outage a day in critical moments of takeoffs and landings. As well, the Airline Deregulation Act and the Civil Service Reform Act became law in October 1978, serving to restrict union rights and worsen working conditions. By the late 1970s, inflation had tripled. Federal workers, unlike those in the private sector, lacked any COLA protections. Emboldened by their skill level, solidarity, and previous victories, the controllers walked. Invoking Taft-Hartley, President Reagan issued a 48-hour back-to-work ultimatum. In a historic move, he fired the strikers, jailed their leaders, and forced costly injunctions that spelled doom for the union and the labor movement. Many labor activists had hoped the Teamsters and machinists would walk out in support. Instead, the strike was a pivotal moment for labor. It ushered in an era of unprecedented attacks not seen since the 1930s. As Robert Weir notes, PATCO's defeat touched off a new wave of downsizing, decertification, and concession strikes. The labor movement continues to suffer its impact today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I had a listener send me a video of just the best in-flight movie I've ever seen. Evidently, there was this snotty little guy who evidently mommy and daddy have money and grandpa too, just screaming and carrying on an airplane. And we find out that evidently he had gone to the restroom, spilled a drink on himself, came out shirtless, and one of the stewardesses was trying to help him find a shirt, and evidently he grabbed her, you know, chest, and, you know, kind of, and then there was an argument that ensued, which is when the camera, you know, comes on, then the guy takes a half a swing at one of the guy stewards, and it was just this fun and craziness in New America. And the steward on the job, and good on him, man. They grabbed the kid, they threw him in the chair, and they duct taped him to the chair. And not just duct taped his body, they shut his mouth with duct tape too. And I'm going, that guy deserves a raise. Now, sadly, he's been suspended with pay pending the investigation. But once the investigation is over, because initially, you know, Frontier Airlines right now was saying, well, it may have gone a little far. No, he didn't go far enough. Did exactly what he should have done. Duct tape him to the seat, close his mouth up, and send him down the road. Now understand, I have a little different mentality on how you deal with things. And this reminded me of the one time in my life that I ever did any babysitting. And look, you definitely didn't want me to babysit your kid. But there was one time. Back when I was in high school, I was a much younger man back then. The superintendent of the school called me into the office. I was in my senior year, and I was the guy everybody ran from. So he calls me in, and he says, "Are you doing something Saturday night?" And I said, "I don't know. Am I being expelled?" And he goes, "No, I need someone to babysit." And I'm going, "Really? Me?" Yeah. He goes, you know, and his kid was in eighth grade. So there weren't, wasn't all that difference in age, a little bit. He goes, well, we can't find a babysitter. And your name came up as someone who might be able to babysit. It didn't dawn on me that going to ask, how did my name come up in a babysitting gig? But it turns out I was probably the only person left in the school who was dumb enough to go, okay. So I show up And, you know, the kid, you know, I said, you know, I guess I'm just going to sit here and we're going to watch TV or whatever. Well, his girlfriend comes over and I said, yeah, they can go out in the back and hang out. And for some reason, they had a police scanner in their living room. And I don't know why you would have a police scanner in your living room, but I turned it on. And oddly enough, within a couple of minutes, I hear a car being dispatched to the area in which we're in, somebody throwing rocks at somebody's house. I'm going, oh, you got to be kidding me. So I go outside, I tell the kid who's holding rocks, get in the house. I tell the girl to get lost. And he's saying, I didn't do anything. So if the police immediately come to this house and, of course, see me and go, what are you doing here? And I'm going, I'm babysitting. And they both look at each other like, you're kidding. I'm going, no. So they said what was going on. I go, no, he's been in the house. I covered for him. I did. And I said, look, you're stuck inside. I can't let you go. So the police leave. Long story short, he runs out the back. Well, I'm faster than he was. I was faster than him. I drag him back. He goes into his room. I'm staying in my room. And look, I'm not stupid. I know how things go. So I go outside and I wait for his little feet to come out of the window and I smack him in the behind with a piece of wood. He goes shooting back in, runs out the door. This is just chaos. So I finally decide that I've had enough. So I go through into the father's closet and I grab a couple of belts and I tie him to a chair, just like these folks did on the airplane. So I'm tying him to the chair. And at one point I finally shoved a sock in his mouth so he would stop screaming. The parents come home, and this is brilliant. The parents come home, and this, I guess, indicative of the time in which we now live in. The mother loses her mind. She's freaking out. Oh, my baby, what have you done? Oh, I can't believe this. You're never babysitting again. And she, you know, takes the stuff off of him. The father gave me an extra $50. It's the time in which that was compared to where we are. It was what it was, but it reminded me of that one single solitary moment where I had someone who was dumb enough to let me babysit their kid. There you go. So all the folks who are going to be angry at me for tying the kid up with a belt, send the email rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do not regret it. I am not going to apologize for it. It was the right thing to do, and I'm all in favor of it. And the other question, what if someone did that to your kid? I would ask, did they deserve it? That's the question we stop asking so much of. You can email me. I do love angry email, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Fact is, America can't wait any longer. Our roads and bridges are crumbling beneath our feet.
Looks like Infrastructure Week is finally happening. County in Washington State passes America's first ever ban on new fossil fuel infrastructure. Plus, massive new wildfires force evacuations in Greece, Turkey, and Italy.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I am not worried. I live in California. The coronavirus in the air is killed by the smoke from the fires. So I...
See? Everything works out just fine. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, maybe... we're actually going to see an infrastructure bill passed? Really?
Maybe. But first, a wildfire's aftermath has led to the closure of a major U.S. interstate highway indefinitely. Interstate 70 through the Rocky Mountains near Glenwood Springs, Colorado, has been shut down after torrential rains caused a massive mudslide on a mountain slope that burned in last year's record wildfire season, trapping about 100 motorists in their cars overnight.
Oh, really?
Now, all were evacuated safely, but Colorado officials called the mudslide damage, quote, unlike anything we've ever seen before.
And I have driven many times on that Interstate 70 through Glenwood in Colorado. It is beautiful. It's shut down Indefinitely?
Yes, it could take months to repair.
Wow.
And now requires hours-long detours, some through Wyoming.
Oh, man.
So that climate-related shutdown arrives just in time for Infrastructure Week, which appears to be actually happening for reals this time after becoming a running joke in the Trump administration. Senate Democrats released details of the nearly $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, which contains $550 billion in new spending over 5 years to repair the nation's crumbling roads, bridges, water, and wastewater infrastructure, including replacing all of the nation's lead service lines. Environment-related provisions include billions in funding for passenger rail and public transit, an electric vehicle charging network, all-electric school buses, cleanup of Superfund and brownfield sites, transmission lines and modernizing the electric grid, carbon capture technologies, advanced battery research, drought mitigation, and coal mine cleanup and reclamation.
This is a big deal, and it's the smaller of the two infrastructure packages they're talking about.
Yes, if this bipartisan bill attracts 10 Senate Republican votes to win passage, it would constitute the largest investment in America since the 1950s. However, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on Monday indicated that Republicans plan to drag out the process.
Uh-oh.
Our full consideration of this bill must not be choked off by any artificial timetable that our Democratic colleagues may have penciled out for political purposes.
Well, too bad. Take as long as they want. Chuck Schumer is not letting them go home for their August recess until they pass this bill.
Now, remember, this is separate from the much larger $3.5 trillion Democrats-only budget reconciliation deal, which can be passed in the Senate with a simple majority vote. But conservative Democratic senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona both have been saying that they have issues with that $3.5 trillion price tag.
Oh, they have. Have issues, all right.
In other news, the climate hits just keep on coming. Last week, Greenland's ice sheet saw a surge in melting during another Arctic heat wave in a single day, releasing enough meltwater to cover the entire state of Florida in 2 inches of water.
Wow.
Six regions around the world are now grappling with massive wildfires driven by extreme heat and drought intensified by man-made climate change. The U.S. West, Ontario, Canada, Russian Siberia, and now a ring of fire around the Mediterranean as more than 800 wildfires burn in Greece, Turkey, and Italy, causing hundreds of millions of dollars in damages and forcing the evacuations of thousands from tourist resorts.
You know, this climate change thing is starting to be a problem.
But some good news. Renewable energy was the second biggest source of electricity generation in the U.S. in 2020, surpassing polluting coal and coming in second only to natural gas, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Renewables were responsible for about 21% of all electricity generated in the U.S. in 2020. Natural gas was number one at around 40% of output.
Natural gas, we're coming for you.
Finally, a victory for activists and anything that breathes in Washington state, the Whatcom County Council just voted to permanently prohibit the approval of any new fossil fuel infrastructure and restrict expansion of existing fossil fuel facilities. The move was spearheaded by new council members who in 2013 worked to defeat a polluting coal export facility and then decided to run for office in their own community.
Nice. Elections matter. Way to go, Whatcom County. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, some fun news out of Ohio. A coal lobbyist evidently won the Republican nomination for Ohio's 15th congressional district. Yeah, coal lobbyist. Backed by Trump. So, Trump's going to declare this victory. The coal folks, victory. Who's going to lose? Well, I would assume the average everyday working stiff, who I'm sure will be left behind. This seat is, I guess, now open because Steve Stivers, I guess, left to become the CEO of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. Better paying gig. And well, Good. Bye. Anyway, we're here to share some thoughts on that and everything else that's going on today. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts with us. Bob, thanks for taking time.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So what do you think? Trump back on? Is he back on the winning streak? He had a little hiccup there in Texas, but his guy in Ohio, you know, came out on top.
Well, he had to win this one because, you know, we had of course, two seats up, the 11th district and the 15th district. Kerry won the 15th district, and, of course, the 11th, the Cuyahoga County, was quite an interesting contest with Nina Turner and, you know, who was backed by Bernie Sanders and AOC and the progressives. And then, of course, they had Chantel was the other candidate,
Brown,
and she was the other candidate, and she was backed by Jim Clyburn, congressman, and also Hillary Clinton. Now, and of course, that's a Democratic seat. And the Kerry, I'm going to call it the Kerry seat because that will be unshakable for the fall. Neither one of these seats are going to, you know, alter anything in Ohio. But for Trump, his advisors actually at one point in time, you know, they didn't want him to enter this race at all. That was the word on the street, and I think anonymous sources in the press, Rick. They didn't want him in it. They were afraid, you know, that the candidate would lose, and if the candidate lost, it was the, you know, two in a row for Trump and therefore signaled something really, really, really bad. Now, on this one, by the way, the race narrowed at one point in time. About maybe 8 or 9 days ago, it began to narrow, and Trump sources or something connected to Trump put in, I think, about $300,000+, and he was encouraged to do that by his advisors because, again, this is one of the seats, you know, that they had to win.
Right.
Now, there were 12 people in this seat, and as a matter of disclosure, you know, as you know from my notes, Mike Kerry 27 years ago ran my campaign, which is hard to believe, you know. So, yeah, 27 years ago he had ran my campaign. And this one had a field of 12. It had three current legislators and then one former. So Trump, you know, the campaign latched on with Mike Kerry, and, you know, the rest is history now.
So, and looking at this, since he was your former campaign manager, would he have gotten your endorsement?
I don't know. Probably if he wanted my help, he might have asked me to endorse somebody else in the race. Please endorse one of the others.
And there were a bunch of them. I mean, when you got 12 running, you might as well, you know, was the janitor involved?
There were a lot of them in this race. Again, it would have been very interesting if it was narrowed down to two or three. But there were, you know, quite a lot of people. So for the Trump campaign, they had to get in all the way with this seat because, again, he was advised not to get into this race. Had nothing to do with Mike Kerry. He was just advised not to get into this race, period, because, again, his people were afraid after Texas, you know, what are you going to do? You don't want to lose another one. So this puts him on one for one, and I think after this we'll have to see what's the next race, you know, and what kind of district is it going to be.
Yeah, no, I think that district was that's a Trump area, isn't it? I mean it's your area.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think you have a better sense than I do, but
yes,
my sense of it is that's a Trump area. So for him to sit that one out would have been even worse than losing, I think.
Right. Well, they were worried. They were worried he would pick the wrong one out of them. Although, I mean, if you look at whether it would have been Ron Hood, who was backed by Ron Paul, or Peterson, who was a sitting legislator, or Jeff Luray, who was a legislator, if you look at any of those he backed, they most likely, of course, you know, would have won. But you never know. And again, I think his campaign's worried about what about number three now?
Yeah.
You know, one loss, one win, what about the next one? Are they going to try to keep him out of them, or are they going to go only for, you know, the Reagan theory? You don't undertake things that you're not sure you're going to absolutely win.
Yeah, you never pick a fight you know you can't absolutely win.
That's it. You got it.
No, and that's, you know, that's the safe way. Then, but here's the thing: that's one of the things that Trump, I don't think, really has done. You know, he's a guy who flies by the seat of his pants. It's one of the things that if you were a supporter that you loved about him, but if you're one of his consultants, you got to be pulling your hair out over.
Right, because I think that the push was on this seat to have went, I mean, Mike Kerry was virtually in that district and unknown, virtually an unknown. He was a coal lobbyist. He wasn't an elected official. And I think within the campaign, Rick, there was probably a desire to go with a sitting legislator. And they didn't do it. Trump met him, was introduced to him, and that ended it. Trump went with him.
Yeah, see, I can't imagine. I got to be honest with you here. A coal lobbyist, I think, as a voter, I would have chosen over a former sitting Ohio legislator. Given their given the level of corruption going on in the Ohio State House.
Well, yes, with the First Energy, but you know, in this situation too, you know how Ohio is. Part of it is King Coal Country still.
Yeah,
may not have as much mining, but it's still King Coal Country.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I got to get your thoughts on the top story of the day. On everybody's mind, everybody's calling for Cuomo to resign. You got the president calling for him. You got the former president calling for him, Obama. You got both senators from the state. All of the voices are saying he's got to go. Does he got to go?
Stick a fork in him. I mean, he has to go. And it might boil down to where he has to do a plea deal.
Really? Because from what I've been reading, I didn't see any charges that were being... Mm-hmm. Levied. I thought from what I read, it was just, he's guilty of all this stuff, but there weren't any charges. Are there charges that I missed?
Well, I agree with you from what I read, but what I also saw in the news reports when some of the officials calling for him to resign are also talking about him being prosecuted. And if they're talking about it, they must have some kind of indicator coming out of the Attorney General's office. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, let's see. Now that would I'd be okay with that. Now you got to go. There is most certainly a you've been tried. There's the door.
Well, what they can do is to try kind of force the issue. And here's the other reality about all this. I know I've been there. Done this. The other reality about this is if you get out, right away, you usually can kind of solve a problem for them. You get out of office, et cetera. If you don't get out right away and you fight it, then you cause a problem for yourself where they're going to say, okay, you're going to go out one way or the other. So when I started to read where some of the officials said, and he may be prosecuted, I thought, okay, this is going to be pushed. If he doesn't move soon, this is going to be pushed on another end to get him out.
Yeah, because they don't run out of time or money.
Right.
But the other part of this is, I don't want this hanging around until next year because there's an election coming up.
Look, and it happens in both parties. So I think, politically, because you make a great point about timing is what you're saying. It happens in both parties. You'll have the things come up, the scandals, et cetera. Then there's the sex scandals, which are usually worse than the scandals. But it's a matter of the timing. This is August. Does he linger around? Do things happen, after the first of the year? How does it affect, New York? I don't think it, necessarily affects, obviously, congressional, records and the congressional runs. But it's not something you want, the first of the year hanging around there. Timing.
You know who the guy who's happiest about all of this is right now? Mike Pence. Mike Pence is the guy who's thrilled over this right this point because everybody mocked him for never being alone in a room with a woman, always having mother around. He's somebody
Saturday
who's
Night
never
going
to have an allegation levied against him.
Right. That's true. I never thought about that. I thought for some reason you were going to say the mayor of New York.
Okay, well, yeah, because the heat's off him now because there's another guy who's thrilled. A lot of guys are thrilled right now.
That happened to me. I was on the front pages, and I got removed off the front pages by Congressman Foley. And so you sit there, and in a strange way, and you can laugh about it. I can now, but in a strange way, you sit there, and some of the other people that are having difficulties are saying, okay, yeah, he put me back. He's on the front pages now.
Yeah, and Foley, didn't he get taken off the front pages by the death of that intern?
Trying to remember which one happened first.
Because it was Gary Condit got himself into trouble
You're right. She was killed, and then it was insinuated that he did it. You're right.
Yeah, because I remember, Foley got some
Foley off the front pages, exactly.
It was like, you know,
to do that.
As the Congress turns, it was like one soap opera thing after another.
Right. You're right.
Either way, I said...
Chandra Levy was her name.
That's her name, yep. But yeah, and it turns out that Condon didn't do it. He ended up resigning or losing, or something happened. And he wasn't even anywhere near involved in it.
Well, and the worst thing about these, you know, I was on the Hill, I was involved in, you know, a scandal. I remember when Gary Condon, this broke, and we went down to go down to the cafeteria in the Longworth building, and people were walking in the hallways and heard these staffers going, and yet there was a dungeon in his the basement in D.C., there's a dungeon, and they're saying all these things that, you know, that wasn't reality, but it becomes reality.
No, and that's the scary thing. I mean, we're so reactionary.
Right.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Also, a horrible tragedy today, and I'm still looking for information on this shooting at the metro station at the Pentagon. A Pentagon officer was killed today. Do we know what happened?
No, I mean, there's not a whole lot of information on it. There was a police officer that died, following the shooting, and that was outside the Pentagon building. Shots were fired, you know, outside the building, and it was the Pentagon agency. It was a protection agency, and it oversees the security. And they were talking about the death. They made some kind of announcement on it, but they said that the Pentagon police officer was killed during the incident, and that's about all I know of it right now.
Yeah, they said there were several casualties, whatever that means. I'm assuming just people injured, and there was no active search for a suspect, but they didn't say if they had the suspect.
Right. They didn't. No, they didn't.
Yeah, we need more information, Bob. And finally, the Missouri Governor Mike Parsons today in the news. He has pardoned the gun-waving couple. The McCloskey, I guess his name is, because I guess he's running for what, Senate there?
Yes. You heard how I said that, didn't you? Yes, he's running for Senate. You know, 5 minutes of fame or infamy doesn't make a person a senator. So I just don't see where that was enough to catapult him into the U.S. Senate.
But, you know, do you think about the power that you got? You got the governor to you know, pardon them of a fourth-degree misdemeanor, is it like a couple hundred buck fine. You know, really a very political move, and the times in which we now live.
Right, and it was. You're right. It's political. I don't think he pardoned them because he, you know, actively is part of the campaign, and you know, but I think they had their moment of fame, and obviously, for him, he's looked at it, and it doesn't weigh against him to do it, yeah. I guess.
While the pandemic raging in his state, this is what doing.
Right, true.
I guess
in fact,
all need
that's one of the states that's not coping well at all.
There you go. But I guess there's the governor of Missouri, Mike Parson. That's what the good folks of the Show Me State voted for. But, Mike, I appreciate the time. Bob, I appreciate the time. It's always good talking with you, man.
Thanks. Thank you, Rick. Bye-bye.
I don't know why I had Mike on the brain other than saying Mike Pence and Mike Parson, both in the same segment. But you know it was Bob. I'll take a quick break right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day that became known in California as the Wheatland Riot. The Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, were trying to organize hop pickers who worked near the city of Wheatland in Northern California. Living conditions for the hop pickers were rough. Durst Ranch was the largest agricultural employer in the state, hiring hundreds of seasonal farm workers each summer. The Durst workers slept in tents. The bathrooms were latrine ditches dug into the ground. The well water they drank was contaminated and foul. The Northern California heat was excruciating, with temperatures soaring above 100 degrees. And while the temperatures were high, the wages were unbearably low. On this fateful day, thousands of workers gathered to hear IWW organizer Richard Ford talk about calling a strike. In response, the local sheriff formed a posse to arrest Ford. During the arrest, one of the posse shot his gun into the air to disperse the crowd. Chaos erupted. Gunfire was exchanged. Four people lay dead, including the district attorney, a deputy sheriff, a worker, and a young boy. Authorities blamed the IWW for the violence. Ford stood trial for causing the riot, even though he had fired no shots. Another Wobbly organizer, who was not even there that day, was also tried for the events at Wheatland. Both received sentences of life in prison for second-degree murder. Today, an historic marker commemorates the site. It explains that the event, quote, focused public opinion for the first time on the plight of California's agricultural laborers and resulted in new state legislation to regulate labor camp conditions. A new state commission on immigration and housing was created to improve working conditions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
And finally, the last story I want to get to. Good on the Chicago area mechanics who went on strike yesterday, affecting some 50 dealerships there in Chicagoland. You had these service centers at the Chicagoland dealerships. I guess they've got like more than 800 technicians who are on strike. At all these dealerships, and they're saying, look, you know, we want better wages, hours, conditions. We want the agreement that the contract you threw us, not sufficient. We're taking representation in the streets, and ultimately this is where I go. Every bit of workers should be able to have the say, because as I'm reading through this article, you know, these dealerships are wildly profitable at this point, and they're nickel and diming people who actually create the wealth that they're enjoying. And, you know, I go back to, you know, this moment in history that we're living through again, and the new Gilded Age, where, you know, the folks at the top doing wildly well, thank you very much. But those of us who are at the bottom struggling just to make it to the next week. And that's most of us in the working class. Haven't seen a substantial raise in decades. Have had retirement security swiped away. Our health security being taken away. You wonder why people are angry. You wonder why there's all this upheaval. Comes back down to the jobs, which is why I keep saying we need good policy to come out of this administration, which is why I said during the Trump years, we needed a massive infrastructure bill. I would have supported wholeheartedly had that been the first club out of Trump's bag. Clearly was not. In fact, we got nothing out of the Trump years. In fact, they didn't even try. That's the most egregious part of the whole thing. That's the political malpractice of the entire thing. They promised and did not even try. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go, wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.